The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. The recent fall of the Iraqi city of Ramadi to the Islamic State underscores the significant challenges facing the United States and Iraq as they attempt to turn back the spread of ISIS control throughout the region. Video from the city's capture depicts Iraqi soldiers fleeing from their substantially outnumbered foe, leaving U.S.-supplied vehicles, weapons, and ammunition behind. In response, President Obama has authorized the deployment of an additional 500 American troops to join the 3,000 already there to train and advise Iraqi forces. While the president has drawn criticism from opponents for stating that he doesn't yet have a complete strategy for the conflict, others wonder whether the United States should still be engaged in Iraq at all. And the debate over how to proceed against ISIS in Iraq and elsewhere will soon be fueled by the contentiousness of presidential election year politics. Today on The Exchange, we're looking at the latest developments with ISIS in Iraq and the American response to it. Let's hear from you. How do you feel about having more U.S. boots on the ground, even in an advisory capacity? What do you think President Obama's complete strategy should be? What should be the role of our allies in the conflict? And if you're already following the presidential race, which candidates seem most persuasive to you on this issue? You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And I have two guests joining me for the show this morning. Joining us on the line from Hanover, New Hampshire is Daniel Benjamin. He is the Norman E. McCulloch Jr. Director of the Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth College. He's also served as Ambassador at Large and Coordinator for the Counterterrorism Center at the U.S. State Department. Ambassador Benjamin, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us by phone from Washington, D.C. is Denise Natali. She is Senior Research Fellow at the Center for Strategic Research in the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University. And Denise Natali, thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Folks, let's hold off talking about President Obama for a moment. I want to give our listeners a sense of the situation on the ground in Iraq and Syria right now. So let's talk first about ISIS. And Ambassador Benjamin, let me start with you. Where are we right now with ISIS in terms of where they are strongest and weakest in the region?
Well, they're strongest across western Iraq, primarily in Anbar province, a large primarily desert area that is home to primarily a Sunni community, and in eastern and northern Syria, where they have been fighting now for a couple of years. So they have a large area that they control, although it's not like they have every single town and city heavily fortified. They're thinly spread out there, but it is a large area.
And Denise, we hear a lot about how ISIS isn't really comprised of just one particular nationality or ethnicity. Talk a little bit about the current composition of ISIS. We hear a lot about people from all over the world essentially coming to join this movement.
Yes, certainly. I mean, you'd have to look, too, at the Iraqi theater and the Syrian theater. Although there is the notion of the caliphate that's broken down borders, in Iraq, those members of ISIS are largely Iraqi. It's largely a local insurgency. Many of the former Iraqi Ba'athist officers and security officers were part of this cabinet. So in Iraq, these are deeply rooted local networks, and I think that to me that is key in understanding the type of challenge you're dealing with. In Syria, there's a larger proportion of foreign fighters, and that could go up to, you know, some say as many as 15,000, 10. That means moving back and forth. Different groups are local Syrian nationalists as well. But nonetheless, there is an element in which there are different groups of Salafists working with former Ba'athist officials, both in Syria and Iraq.
So, Denise, it doesn't sound like this is an especially hierarchical organization. It's just, you know, we hear about it popping up in Iraq and in other parts of the world as well.
Well, I mean, I would say there's two parts. There's what's going on the ground, and then you're asking how is this affecting different theaters. Right. Within Iraq, I would say that this is a group which is highly porous. Mm-hmm. The networks extend into areas where there are, you know, different groups joining, passersby coming in and out. You have, again, as I said, former regime elements. You have different groups of Islamic radical groups, again, moving in and out. In Syria, Nusra's been with them and been out. So I wouldn't say hierarchical. I would look across localities and see how it's functioning and types of alliances and networks it has across these regions.
And Ambassador Benjamin, does it seem like they have a clear strategy, or are they just very kind of opportunistic? Or maybe both?
Yes, there is an element of both. I think that they are that their key goal is to seize and hold territory, and that is the key to their recruitment success and their general rise of their profile in the extremist world. So that's that's the number one objective, and then they're opportunistic about their targeting. But they have gone after some rather meaty targets in Mosul and Ramadi and a number of other cities.
Let me ask you your take also on the composition in general, sort of differences between Iraq and Syria and elsewhere.
Well, I think Natalie probably knows more about this than I do, but I think what's quite remarkable is the extraordinary number of foreign fighters who have been drawn to Iraq and Syria, far exceeding what we saw in either Iraq after 2003 or in Afghanistan before, and probably far exceeding what we saw in Afghanistan during the jihad of the 80s. These numbers are very high, 20,000 or so. And when you consider that the coalition has claimed to have killed thousands upon thousands, it suggests that this pool is being replenished quite quickly. And my understanding from government sources is that the trajectory of people moving to the region continues to be upward.
Mm-hmm. Denise, do we know what actually happened in Ramadi? You know, we all saw, or a lot of us saw, this video that kind of went viral of the Iraqi forces fleeing and leaving behind a lot of our equipment. And at least the reporting suggested that they actually outnumbered ISIS significantly in Ramadi, yet they just kind of melted away.
Yeah, I can't mention the specific details, but there are some, you know, there's great debate, and the Iraqis were quite miffed about the statements coming in that they didn't have the will to fight. Some of it has to do with equipment. Some of it had to do within the areas that they were in as well. One of the clear statements coming out of this is that there were Sunni tribes that just were not willing to still take on ISIS. And I think that this is what should be looked at. Not only are the Iraqis capable and they're not capable, do they have the equipment, but why is it that after a year that still many of the Sunni tribes can't or are not willing to counter ISIS as well? There aren't Shia in Anbar. So, you know, this to me indicates how it is embedded in the social fabric of some of these Sunni communities, and it's beyond, in my view, some of the military capabilities that the Anbaris have or they don't have.
Mm-hmm.
This is intra-tribal as much or alongside ISIS against the Iraqi government.
Right, and I want to talk about that, but I want to first let our listeners know that we're talking about the latest on ISIS in Iraq today. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. It's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Ambassador Benjamin, let me go back to you on this as well. If you know anything about Ramadi, that would be great, but I do want to sort of shift to talking about what Denise just mentioned, which are kind of the larger ethnic dimensions politically in the country, maybe talk a little bit about some of the issues that the Iraqi government has had in being a unifying force. They've had a new prime minister now for about 8 months. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, on Ramadi, I think that Secretary of Defense Ash Carter's remark that we need a partner who has the will to fight is at the macro level sums things up. It might have been unfair to some of the forces who are in Ramadi who had been fighting for many months against ISIS attacks, but I think that it is a correct statement of the big picture, and it's reflective of the fact that that Iraq as a state still hasn't reformed its military sufficiently or retrained its military sufficiently to be an effective fighting force, and that is also indicative of the sectarian, if you will, distortion that has occurred after the years of governance by Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. The army was largely gutted. It was seen as an untrustworthy institution, and much more emphasis was put on Shia militias. And recouping that loss, you know, rebalancing the state is a long-term and very difficult project, and it's not even clear it can succeed. The new prime minister, Haider al-Abadi, appears to have the right idea and a desire to go forward and to reintegrate Sunni elements into the government, into the military, but he is he doesn't rule the roost, as it were, entirely, and he has to balance that against lots of forces in Baghdad, which are tilting towards Shia sectarianism, tilting towards Iran, and which are reluctant to see Sunnis in Anbar armed and therefore dangerous. And many of the forces in Anbar at the tribal level have also sort of had it with Baghdad and are not eager to re-embrace the sort of unitary state or to work with the national government. And some of them may see ISIS as a better bet or just simply sitting on the sidelines as a better bet, given what they've been through.
So would you say, Daniel, that the new prime minister, though, has kind of been an improvement from the U.S. perspective?
He's definitely been an improvement from the U.S. perspective, and my sense is that Washington thinks highly of him, but I think it's an open question as to whether or not he can pursue a policy that would satisfy U.S. Goals and whether he can really get some traction there.
Denise, I want your thoughts on this as well, but first we're going to need to take a brief break. But coming up, lots more in Iraq. We'll talk about President Obama. We're even going to talk about foreign policy in the 2016 presidential race as well. So please stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange, and I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, we're taking a look at the ISIS advance in Iraq. We invite you to call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us a short email at exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. I have two guests with me for the show today. Daniel Benjamin, he's director of the Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth College, and Denise Natale, who is senior research fellow in the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University. And Denise, let me go back to you on the topic we were just discussing for the break. I think a lot of people following Iraq may know that there were issues that the U.S. had with Prime Minister al-Maliki and that there was a change about 8 months ago, but not much more about kind of the political dynamics within the country. So let me get your take on what Daniel was talking about before the break.
Certainly. A lot of people had problems with al-Maliki, probably all of Iraq. I think it's important, and I agree with Ambassador, that this is the new prime minister who I had the honor of meeting when he was in town a couple of months ago is certainly a different character, and he is one that has reached out, that is trying to desectarianize the militia and reach out to Sunni Arabs. The problem is not only the individual himself. You've got these hardline Shia groups still with Maliki trying to undermine Abadi. So it's not just that this Sunni Shia dichotomy, which I think, in my view, has been oversimplified. But there's divisions within the Shia group. There are many Shia Iraqis that do not like Iran. It's very important to understand that the Iraqis are still, particularly the Shia Iraqi nationalists, and there have been reactions, particularly by Ayatollah Sistani, Abadi, about Iranian overstep. Secondly, there are Sunni Arabs also fighting with the Shia militia, the Iraqi security forces, in Anbar. So, as I said, there are tribal issues. It's complicated. There are, you know, cross-sectarian issues, and of course there are ethnic issues between the Iraqi Arabs and the Kurds. Abadi's got his hands full, and he is, again, trying to manage these, you know, Iran reaching in, hardliner Shias, and at the same time push back ISIS. There is a great deal of distrust still, largely by the Sunni Arab community, against the Iraqi government, not only because of previous discrimination by Maliki, but because of the Shia militia retaliating against the Arabs, because of the fact that the Arabs, Sunni Arabs, think that, you know, they're still, this whole campaign is against them. So we've had a few Sunni Arabs say, is this a campaign against ISIS, or is it a campaign against Sunni Arabs? Each one of these groups feels aggrieved and as victims, and they're using this sense of victimization, one, to seek more weapons and support from the United States, and again, to retaliate against each other. So you're seeing a great retrenchment of every community in Iraq into their own territories, seeking with their own militia. You know, the proliferation of militia in Iraq is remarkable. And these are some of the dynamics on the ground in which Abadi has to manage alongside ISIS.
Mm-hmm. Ambassador Benjamin, I think it was in 2008, Vice President Joe Biden, I think he was then a presidential candidate at the time, suggested that we may need to have that Iraq may need to be partitioned into, you know, sort of autonomous areas with the Sunnis dominating one, Shiite the other, and Kurds the third. I remember at the time he was kind of roundly mocked for suggesting that. What's your take on that now? I mean, given what Denise just described in terms of kind of the sectarian problems, is that a reasonable solution, or would that be a mistake?
Well, I don't think it's something that can easily be achieved. It was Vice President Biden's proposal was heavily criticized at the time because there was much more mixture of populations in various geographical areas of Iraq at the time. They don't simply break down into three easily defined areas. There has been an awful lot of ethnic cleansing since then,
right,
and there is less heterogeneity than there used to be. But I think that even today, achieving a separation, which may be inevitable, will be quite difficult because at the end of the day, the Kurds get a significant amount of oil and natural resources. The Shia would, too, if we go along the sort of predictable lines of separation. And the Sunnis get a lot of sand. And that is a recipe for a war that will go on for many, many years. It is, Iraq has struggled to come up with a hydrocarbon law that would see an equitable distribution of revenue. And some success was made in that area. I think, you know, that has been undermined by the sectarian fighting that has been going on. And it's at the moment, you know, it'd be great if we could figure out a way to make it all equitable again, but there are no good solutions here. There's really no silver bullet at all.
Denise, your thoughts on the partition idea, and then I would like to hear you say a little bit more about the Kurds. We haven't talked about them much yet, and this is an area where you have some expertise.
Yeah, I agree with the ambassador. Vice President Biden may have made that statement about partition, but he also recently said that Iraq remains unified, as weakened as it is. And for the very reasons that Ambassador discussed, this is not simply a three-part Iraq with Shia, Sunni, and Kurd. These communities have been mixed. You have incredible amount of demographic change even since the last year, so that 20% of the Sunni Arab population are in the north. You have within the Sunni community, there is no Sunni group that wants their own state apart from Iraq. maybe some Sunni groups have called for a Sunni region. Others have called for a different province. Others have called for closer, stronger central government. So Sunnis are Iraqi nationalists. There aren't Shias who want to separate from Iraq. Even in Basra, that won't go over because at the end of the day, they're loyal to Sistani, who will not separate. So you have the Kurds asking for this, and even within the Kurdish region, they're not completely unified under what these territories would look like. So the bigger problem would be how to manage the borders inside Iraq that are shifting and these competitions between these groups over resources and revenues. But I don't. The idea of this breakup of Iraq into three or five neat groupings is I really find almost Pollyanna-ish, and I don't think people inside are seriously talking about it. The Iraqis would say the United States wants to break up Iraq more than we do. So I just think it's too difficult. Mm-hmm. Back to the Kurds. Yes, the Kurds, if they, you know, it's complicated. They've captured the hearts and minds of folks. They've got an incredibly strong lobby, and they've proven to be capable partners on the ground. And I talk about now the Kurds in Iraq, since we're talking about Iraq. But there are some problems, and the problems are when you choose to have local partners to act as coalition partners on the ground to do your work, there are going to be second and third order consequences to this. And one of them has been using coalition weapons and support to take more territories, which is fueling intra-ethnic, this is not just sectarian, rivalries between Kurds and Arabs in these very sensitive areas called the disputed territories. So the Kurds have been the greatest beneficiaries of the post-2003 settlement in Iraq, and they have captured a large deal of lobbying and international support. But what matters as well is what's going on the ground. And during this anti-ISIS campaign, with the help of coalition support, the Kurds have been able to take more territories, resources, and I see another battle waiting to happen if this is not delicately managed. They now have a 1,000-kilometer border with radical Sunni Arab groups. This you saw coming over the last 8 years. And again, there's going to have to be some form of local power sharing between Kurds and Arabs, because many of these oil fields the Kurds took don't belong to them. They belong to the disputed territories.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Democratic voters often say to me now, well, you know, Vice President Biden wasn't so far off the mark after all. But listening to what both you and Ambassador Benjamin said, it sounds like it's actually a pretty complicated idea even now. I want to tell our listeners they can call in and join our discussion on ISIS in Iraq at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. How do you feel about having more U.S. boots on the ground? What do you think President Obama's complete strategy should be? I want to segue now to start talking about the Obama administration response or lack of response, depending on your perspective, and with this initial idea that we're going to send over another 500 trainers slash advisors to help out. And I'm going to go to you, Ambassador Benjamin. I was watching TV a few days ago, and I saw an Obama administration official whose name I unfortunately can't recall, who said something to the order of, well, they just need more time. They'll just need a little more time to stand up. And this is something I've been hearing for a long time. And so my initial question to you in terms of as we shift to talking about U.S. policy is, is it really just an answer of more training or is that just kind of a way to sort of buy time?
I think the short answer is we don't really know. We certainly need more time. The key necessary ingredient for beating back ISIS is a ground force. We can strike them from the air as often as we want, but we're not going to be able to really do the kind of critical damage to the group that is necessary through air power alone. That is a longstanding sort of fact of warfare. And I think it is a smart policy to try to train up the Iraqi military to do the job, because of all the flawed options here for attacking ISIS, that is still the best. But it is not at all clear, given the politics in Baghdad, given the military situation on the ground, that this is going to be sufficient, possible even, or timely enough to take down ISIS, the few pegs that it absolutely needs to be taken down. And so I think it makes sense to continue with a train and assist mission the way that's been outlined. But it's just not clear it's going to succeed.
Denise, your thoughts. Is it really just an issue of training?
No, I don't think so. And I don't think that putting more boots on the ground is the answer either, because this is not a problem that requires just a military solution. It's essentially a political problem. So, looking at trying to defeat ISIS, I think, is a mistake. And we should look more at trying to contain or degrade ISIS, because, as I said before, I see this as a very deeply ingrained political issue that emerged in the post-2003 Iraqi settlement, which is obviously now being affected by regional actors, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey. So training more could help. But I don't criticize the president at all in the sense of showing great reticence into getting back involved in Iraq into a problem that we don't know how long is going to take, and it's far more complicated than the good guys and the bad guys. So, my question would be, what is the end state? What are we hoping? To just defeat ISIS? To stabilize the region? We're talking about another 10, 20-year commitment. So there are a lot of folks who are still, sore from all of these engagements in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it just as it was difficult to disengage the Taliban from Afghan society, I would look at ISIS as, again, getting more ingrained in the social fabric of some of these regions. The extent to which, 10,000 troops, 500 military advisors can do this, that's just part of it. We have coalition partners that we need to work with, clamping down on borders where ISIS can move in and out. You have regional actors who can make an influence as well, checking Iranian influence. There's a lot of other areas in which U.S. policy, in my view, can be effective or can keep being effective. But at the end of the day, it's the will of some of these groups to engage.
My guests joining me today to talk about ISIS in Iraq are Daniel Benjamin. He's director of the Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth College, and Denise Natale, who's a senior research fellow at the National Defense University. And you can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. And folks, let's go to the phones now. Joining us from Manchester is Bruce. Bruce, welcome to the exchange.
Good morning. Good morning. I don't want to sound like a defeatist, but the conversation to me sounds like a conversation we've been having since 2003. We need more training. We need more training. The Iraqis need more time. I listened to the speakers this morning. The situation has gotten more complex in the last 3 to 5 years instead of less complex. And it may be too simplistic a question, but perhaps we can't affect this situation, and we're going down another wormhole here.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Continue.
So the question is, really, are we just trying to buy time because we have a policy that's not working and we really can't be effective in really affecting the situation in Iraq?
Great. Thanks, Bruce. Let me go to you, Ambassador Benjamin. This sort of piggybacks on what I said about it. This is just kind of stalling for time. Your thoughts?
Well, I understand Bruce's perception on this, and to some extent, I share it. Here's the situation. We face a whole bunch of really bad options. We have a large extremist group, ISIS, occupying an enormous amount of territory. We are concerned that if they continue to have success, that they will ignite even more the imaginations of people who are prone to extremism in the broader Muslim world. And while that is a small part of the broader Muslim world, the Muslim world is more than 1.2, 1.3, 1.4 billion people, so those numbers add up. And we don't want them all traveling there. We don't want them all acting up at home and carrying out self-starter or lone wolf attacks. We also don't want that broad area to be an unchallenged safe haven where terrorists can plot. And I'm more skeptical about ISIS as a terrorist threat to the United States than many, but nonetheless, you have to take this seriously. So we can't just walk away, pleasant though that might be, appealing though that might be. And we need to come up with the best strategy we can. And I still think that, at least for now, although I'm have my doubts about whether Iraq will survive as a unitary state, I think that this is the best option we have. I agree very much with Dr. Natale that we're looking more at a containment strategy than a strategy to destroy ISIS, as the president suggested. I don't see how that's going to happen, especially because we don't have a strategy at all for Syria. But you know, this is statecraft. You have to deal with the situation you have, and if you walk away, you may have to face far worse consequences.
Denise, we're coming up on a break shortly, but I'd love to have your thoughts on Bruce's call as well.
Yes, thanks, Bruce, for your call. You're not a defeatist. You're probably more realistic in your assessment. I wouldn't, though. Some people are saying the word stalling for time. I would see this as there's a more clearer calculation that the United States knows the hand it's dealing with after Iraq and Afghanistan post-2003 and the failures that emerge, and they do not want to have that type of engagement in boots on the ground. So this is, you know, building the airplane while you're flying it, so to speak, but working with local partners means not having the exact outcomes or direct outcomes that you think that you would normally have or you could have managing this yourself. So stalling for time would assume that we don't necessarily know completely what we're doing, as opposed to we don't want to get directly engaged again. There will not be, in my view, large troops on the ground. So working with the Iraqi Air Force, you know, military forces. But there's another important part that the United States is doing, and that is reinforcing, or at least trying to reinforce, its commitment to the Iraqi government, working with coalition partners, trying to get regional states on board, whether they will or not. But, you know,
we need to take, let me jump in. Let me jump in just 1 second here. We need to take one more quick break, and we'll be back to talk lots more about ISIS in Iraq. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange, and I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today we're discussing ISIS in Iraq. You can join us by calling in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us, exchange@nhpr.org. And today I'm joined by Daniel Benjamin, who's director of the Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth College, and Denise Natale, who's senior research fellow at the National Defense University. And Denise, I want to go back to you. I'm sorry I had to jump in there, but I want you to finish your thought. And I thought it was interesting. You know, I'm one of the individuals who use the word stalling, and I think it's my tendency to see things largely as political strategy. So your point on that is well taken. But let you finish your thought before we go back to the phones.
No, I'm just pointing out that, as an ambassador noted, there are no good options here. But it is not as unclear as it appears that there has been a clear decision not to be directly engaged, and therefore to have the Iraqis themselves or to have regional actors or local partners or coalition partners become involved or take as much responsibility. This is, you know, at the end of the day, has to be, you know, an Arab project with a Muslim face, as we say, at least when you're talking about some of these countering ISIS media campaigns. And so it has to come locally as well. And I think the United States is trying to understand that and work in that manner.
Mm-hmm. And Bruce, thanks for your call before the break. And let's go back to the phones, and we have Dylan standing by in New London. Welcome to The Exchange.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
What's up?
Hey, I was just wondering how you all see the Rojava Revolution and the Kurds in northern Syria and what they're doing playing into the conflict, why the United States isn't funding or supplying them, because they're taking cities right now. And, yeah. I guess that's about it.
Okay. Daniel Benjamin, let me start with you, and then we'll go back to Denise Natale.
Oh, I think Dr. Natale probably has much more informed things to say about the Kurds than I do, so why don't I punt over to her?
Okay, happy to do that. Denise Natale, your thoughts.
Thanks. Yeah, this is another complicated question. First of all, these Kurds in northern Syria, we need to differentiate between the Kurds in Iraq. There are two main groups. The Kurds in Iraq have been longstanding U.S. allies. The Kurds in Turkey or Syria are part of the group called the Kurdistan Workers Party or affiliated with them. Turkey is a U.S. ally, remains a U.S. ally, so this is a very sensitive issue for Turkey in the sense that empowering the Kurds in Syria, who are largely tied to the PKK, is, in Turkey's view, a threat to its territorial integrity. With that said, probably the most effective fighting force in Syria and unified are these PYD, Kurdish Syrian Kurds, as you called the word Rojava, which means it's a term used among Kurds, West Kurdistan region. Nonetheless, why the U.S. is not funding or supplying them directly, they are being provided weapons either indirectly through the KRG, the Kurds in Iraq. But again, the PKK is still considered a terrorist group. The PYD is distinct, and they've managed to work around it, but it is a politically sensitive issue. On the one hand, you have expelling ISIS, the same processes are going on in northern Iraq with the Kurds, expelling ISIS with our local partners, but the secondary and third order consequences of this are what? The Kurds are expanding and taking more territories. You now have concerns about Arab communities. They're sometimes using the word ethnic cleansing, which is being disputed by Kurds. And Turkey is pretty much up in arms right now about the fact that the Kurds have recently not only effectively taken this key ISIS border area in Tel Aviv, but they now have a larger area which they're connecting, which has moved Arabs out. So it's a sensitive issue that involves territorial expansion, Kurdish nationalism, and Turkey's worried about territorial integrity of its country that borders this area. So the United States, in my view, is balancing its alliance with Turkey and the need to rely on effective local partners on the ground who are pushing out ISIS.
Mm-hmm. Dylan, thanks for that call. Let me turn back to you, Ambassador Benjamin. When I heard President Obama recently, I think it was a week or so ago, say that he doesn't yet have a complete strategy, and I recalled that he had said that as well in August of 2014. What do you think he meant by that? I'm asking you to speculate here, but what might a complete strategy look like?
I'm not sure a complete strategy is possible because I think what the president, at least in part, has been referring to is the Syrian problem, where there is really no good solution available. You have essentially a civil war that's been going on now for several years, and every time it seems like there might be a tilt in the balance of power. One side or the other pushes more chips in, that is, puts more money into the groups it's backing, whether it's on the Shia Alawite side or on the Sunni side. And the unfortunate fact is that this is the central drama for the entire region. And I was recently out in the Gulf, and it's quite remarkable how much more people are focused on the issue of Sunni-Shia tensions than they are on the rise of extremism. And I think that this is going to confound American and Western policymakers for a long time to come. There may have been a time when there were moderate groups in the center who we might have worked with and built up, but that has passed, and there's been a really big polarization, and we don't have any natural partners. We are training some Syrians to go and fight, but it's still unclear whether they're going to do what we want and fight ISIS or whether they're going to wind up fighting the Assad regime. So I think that's part of what the president meant. I think the other part of what he meant was what I was discussing before, which is the difficulty of finding a suitable partner who's going to be the ground force to take the fight to ISIS. I think that right now the Kurds have shown themselves to be extremely effective, but over-reliance on the Kurds and the shipment of lots of weaponry to the Kurds continues to raise the possibility that Kurdish nationalism will be stoked and that a desire for the KRG to go its own way will become sort of a runaway train. And that, while many people think that might be the best solution, there are just too many imponderables about intercommunal violence and about the kinds of problems that I discussed before about the Sunnis not getting an equitable stake in the national wealth. So, you know, I think the president has been perhaps dangerously honest about the situation. It won't help him politically, but it is an accurate reflection of the fact that the options are just not great.
Mm-hmm. Denise Natale, your thoughts on the concept of a complete strategy?
Yeah, I pretty much agree with what the ambassador said. And again, this is a very fluid movement, very fluid situation on the ground, so that what's happening in Iraq as well is different, as, although we want to clump it together with Syria. It is different than what's happening in Syria. As much as we want the Syrian regime to fall, we're not prepared for a collapse of the Syrian regime at this time, in my view, so that almost working with what we have at the moment, and again, we have an elephant in the room, and it's called Iran. And there was mention to the larger regional sectarian issues between Saudi Arabia and Iran and what's happening elsewhere. But trying to manage some of these larger issues, I think which one of them is the nuclear negotiations with Iran, how that will play out in Syria, how that can play out in Iraq, is also part of this dynamic here. I mean, it wouldn't be surprising to say, let the Iranians bleed in Syria. And we come in or we come in and benefit from that. There's a lot of different options, and I don't know necessarily that the president didn't put them on the table or not. But the reticence, to me, this indicates the reticence to get deeply involved after some of the consequences that emerged in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I don't see that changing for the near term.
And let me ask you this, Denise, is there any I don't use the word hope, but is there any possibility for the U.S. to coordinate with Iran in Iraq, or is that just too politically and regionally fraught for that to happen?
I mean, I can't speak for – I'm speaking on my own behalf. Yeah. But, you know, the United States and Iran, in my view, have a common enemy, which is ISIS,
right.
But there's still – you know, many problems within alliances, between, you know, within what can and what can be negotiated. So there are no direct communications with the Iranians and coordination. Where airstrikes are occurring, as far as I know, they're not occurring in areas where there are Shia groups.
Mm-hmm.
And this has affected what areas have been targeted and what haven't been. I think there's been a lot of care taken not to reinforce any support of the Shia militia. So that still remains. But again, we have other issues about negotiating the nuclear deal and how I would look at how that is going to affect Syria, because one of Bashar Assad's main supporters still at this time is Iran.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, let me have your thoughts briefly on Iran, and then I want to talk a little bit about the 2016 foreign policy debate.
Well, let me just build on what Natalie had to say. You know, there may be some very low-level coordination in the sense that if we're carrying out airstrikes in some place, we don't want Iranian-related groups to be bombed, because that would cause all kinds of unwanted problems. But in general, I think that any effort to coordinate more with Iran is not in our interest. It's not in our interest because we ultimately don't want Iran to have more influence in Iraq. And it's not in our influence because our coalition partners will become irate. And, you know, right now they're thinking beyond all else about the spread of Iranian influence, Iranian subversion in some areas. And frankly, Iran is still not a friend of ours by any stretch of the imagination. Indeed, I think one of the big fears in the Gulf, but also in Washington, is if we do get a nuclear deal, what does the day after look like? What does it look like when Iran has a lot more money and can have an even more aggressive foreign policy. So I really don't see us, coming to the conclusion that the enemy of my enemy is my friend here.
Right.
That's a failure.
Mm-hmm. We have about 5 minutes left, and I want to shift focus a little bit to the 2016 presidential race, where it seems like, particularly on the Republican side, foreign policy and ISIS is resonating more than it sometimes does in presidential races. And Ambassador Benjamin, let me start with you this time first on this. I've noticed that it seems in recent months, Republican candidates in particular are increasingly comfortable talking about the idea of reengaging with troops in Iraq. And I'm wondering how you think that's going to play out going forward.
Well, I think that there's a certain amount of schizophrenia right now. If you set aside Rand Paul, Republican candidates are trying to outbid each other as to who would be toughest against Islamist extremists. And so they're eager to come up with a tough-sounding policy. They're eager to bash the Obama administration and, by extension, the Democrats, and to undermine any Democratic nominee. At the same time, I think they're very, very leery of coming out and saying that they want to put 10,000 troops on the ground. There are polls that show that Americans could contemplate that and would support that, but I think that support is, as they say, a mile wide and an inch thin, and could evaporate. So I think the Republicans have a real challenge to come up with an effective, serious policy on this, while at the same time maintaining the very heated rhetoric about going after ISIS.
And Denise Natale, let's talk a little bit about your thoughts on this. And it's interesting, as Daniel Benjamin mentioned, I had in my notes, aside from Rand Paul, this sense that they're starting to outbid each other on the Republican side to get back to reengage in Iraq.
I think they hope Iraq will go away by then, quite frankly. I mean, this has just been, this is not the issue or the agenda that I don't think any of them want to deal with. But this could largely be rhetoric, I mean, for several reasons. I don't think by the time it's for a new presidential election to really get into gear that we have the domestic will or the finances or in revenues, given our budget problems, to back large-scale troops in Iraq. I don't see how the Republicans are going to handle this. So there could be other ways of, whether that be targeting ISIS through, social media or whatever it is, but the troops on the ground is going to will cause them problems, particularly when you also have to deal with some of the very serious revenue and finance budgetary issues that they haven't dealt with. So I my question would be, who would back it?
Mm-hmm. Well,
and
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes. No, go ahead.
Yeah, so it sounds like what you're saying is, they may use the rhetoric in the short term, but they're hoping they won't have to confront the reality if one of them actually wins.
I think they'll kick the can down the road that they've been doing for a while. But again, this problem in Iraq is largely, I don't want to take political sides, but it largely came from the Bush administration. And then post-2003, the breaking up of Iraq, the disbandment of the Sunni Arab army, the de-Baathification, the whole nine yards. When you talk about ISIS, most Sunni Arabs will say this was a reaction to the entire post-2003 order. So, this, if there's any lessons identified, is that a lot of this is not as easy as sending in more troops. I don't see how they are going to market this idea of sending more troops in.
Daniel Benjamin, real quick, we have a short time left. Hillary Clinton, Lincoln Chafee has suggested that her Iraq vote years ago is going to be problematic. Do you think so or not?
I don't think so. I think she's been quite explicit about how she regretted that vote. And, our polity works on the basis of a certain amount of trust between the different branches of the government. She believed the administration about the intelligence that was brought to bear and about their assessment of the inclinations of Saddam Hussein and his regime. She's backed away from that, I think, pretty dramatically, and I don't think that Governor Chafee is really going to get a lot of traction with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. I think we're all going to be watching to see whether ISIS can consolidate its gains and where the United States will go next in response. I'd like to thank both of my guests for joining us this morning. Daniel Benjamin, thanks so much for your time again this morning.
It's always a pleasure.
That's Ambassador Daniel Benjamin. He's the Norman E. McCulloch Jr. Director of the Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth College. He also served as Ambassador at Large and Coordinator for Counterterrorism at the U.S. Department of State. And Denise Natale, we really appreciate you joining us for the show this morning.
Thank you very much.
That's Denise Natale. She is Senior Research Fellow at the Center for Strategic Research at the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.